Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
Spice expands life.
We explore the mysteries of the universe and
Spice
of the Earth.
Expands consciousness.
Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. And we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. We have quite a program for you tonight. So much going on in current events, both in science, in politics, world government, economy. It is hard to keep up with, but we will do our best. That's why you tune in here at the end of the week or the beginning of the week, however you look at it, to get the scientific perspective, to put things on an even keel, to realize where the past meets the future. How does it look? What should we do? Where should we position ourselves? Well, the solar activity tonight is low, with a mild solar breeze of about 395 kilometers per second. And there are only three sunspot clusters on the sun today, but gigantic sunspot 1743 is visible with a small telescope. It is huge and capable of beta-gamma M-class flares. But so far, nothing. The biggest sunspot on the Earth side of the sun. It has been quiet for days, even though it has been this massive beta-gamma magnetic field. We'll keep you safe. By the way, not all flares are bad things. We kind of need them to help build our atmosphere. Our telephone number tonight, live anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. Don't forget about the conference line. Many, many of our listeners use this. It's very handy. You can listen to the program on your cell phone. The number is 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. Put it on speed dial, save it on your contact list, and then put the passcode 769-608 pound. And you can listen to the program while you're out shopping or taking that walk around the park, getting ready for your week to begin. Now, a lot of people are asking me, what will Comet Ison do? Believe me, I hear and get mail about all kinds of fears, most of them unfounded. Comet Ison will hit Earth. Comet Ison will be the harbinger of the second coming. All kinds of things. Comet Ison is the blue Kachina, which it may be. I will tell you one thing. You've heard lots of things about Comet Ison, but I wanted to give you my analysis and a short audio piece by NASA as maybe perhaps a contrast. There are some amazing things about this comet, beginning with the discovery. It was found with a pretty small telescope, only 40 centimeters across. That's why it's named Ison. This comet's coming out of the dreaded Oort cloud. Some of them come from another maelstrom in our solar system, much less devastating to the planet. The very elliptical orbit of Comet Ison indicates it is probably a first-timer out of the maelstrom of cometary chaos. We will actually see it first, and then we will feel it. Now, here's what I mean. Comet Ison will get within less than 1 million miles of the sun. That's right next door. It will be baking off layer after layer of ice and dust, just like an onion baking off its skin. But remember that when something boils off its surface, it acts like a wet rag in the wind. It gets very cold. Very cold, thus refreezing the core and making it very tough to destroy with just infrared energy from the sun. Now, it may be overcome by the gravity of the sun getting so close, but as far as boiling away, it actually has quite the opposite effect. The tail will become very long. Very long, many millions of miles, and very bright. Most people, with clear blue skies overhead, during the day, will be able to see it in broad daylight. Now, that's scary. That's scary. We've never had a comet like that, not in your lifetime, and certainly not in the last few hundred years. But fear not. While Comet Ison is visible like this, it will be more than 90 million miles away from Earth. Not even close. Several planet distances away. Then, around the end of November, the tail will be pointed away from us, making it look more like a fuzzball in space. By the way, get a pair of decent binoculars. Just go down to the local Chinese supplier store and get a decent pair of binoculars for $30. And then make a brace for your office chair. Office chairs sometimes have arms, and you could make a PVC brace. I'll say, be happy to send you the prints if you write me. And you could put it together with just simple old pipe glue. And you could either use wire ties, or you can use a kid's bungee cords from Walmart or something, and you can fasten this pair of binoculars across the PVC pipe over your head, and then you can just lean back and adjust the binoculars so that you don't have to hold those puppies and try to hold them still. You can sit in the office chair for hours and watch the comet. It's going to be quite fascinating, and you should be able to watch it for hours every night until almost Christmas. Just about the same time, we may feel the effects of Comet Ison on Earth. Now, what do I mean by that? That's about the time we should fly right through the tail left behind by that original bake-off I was telling you about. Now, it won't be visible anymore because then it'll be 93 million miles away from the sun. But it will be filled with billions of cubic yards of frozen methane and CO2. If there's a spark, we could have another Chicago fire. In any case, if there is a collision, it will be a phenomenal shower of bright flashes and perhaps a serious bump in our greenhouse gas levels. Let me play a little piece from NASA. They did a really dandy piece on this. It's about 4 minutes long. Listen to what they have to say about it.
Comets are scary looking things. Seeing them up there, their long tails sprayed across the pristine calm of our night sky, it's easy to understand how they have terrorized our imaginations for so long. For centuries, humanity has worried, where do they come from? Are they going to hurt us? Why do they appear, gradually getting larger and larger? Will they leave us alone? Sometimes, comets do hit the Earth. Earth's history is full of comet impacts, huge collisions that have changed the nature of our planet. These collisions would have wrought terrible destruction, but they're also credited with bringing water and other essential elements for life to Earth. Why do they hit us? Well, that depends on what type of comet we're talking about. There are two main types of comets, characterized primarily by where they come from. Comets usually originate in one of two places, Kuiper Belt or the Oort Cloud. Comets from the Kuiper Belt are short-period comets that follow orbits around the Sun and make repeat visits to our night sky. Comet Halley is like this. It becomes visible from Earth every 75 to 76 years. Most of these comets return within 20 years or less. The most dangerous orbits, however, come from the second type, the long-period comet. These celestial bodies originate from the outer edges of the solar system, beyond the orbit of Neptune. These long-period comets are gravitationally kicked out of their safe orbits, tucked far away in the Oort cloud. They then form highly elongated orbits that pass across the path of the planets. Long-period comets follow parabolic and sometimes hyperbolic trajectories. These are the most dangerous to the Earth, as their paths and inclinations are the most extreme. These are the comets to keep your eyes on. And in September 2012, we found one. We call it Comet Ison, after the Russian observatory known as the International Scientific Optical Network that discovered it. This chunk of ice and rock, a few kilometers across, was found using only a 40-centimeter telescope. Its orbit has been measured and is probably parabolic, meaning Ison is a long-period comet, and it will pass extremely close to the Sun. The parabolic orbit indicates that this is probably Comet Ison's first pass ever through our solar system. But regardless of whether it has a hyperbolic or parabolic orbit, one question looms large. Will Comet Ison actually hit the Earth? Current projections of the comet's trajectory show it will reach its closest approach to Earth on December 26, 2013, where it will pass no closer than 63 million kilometers overhead. So it appears the Earth will get a pass on this one. However, in January 2014, the Earth will swing past a part of space that Comet Ison already traveled through at a distance of only 4.4 million kilometers. This encounter brings up the possibility of a meteor shower on Earth. Meteor showers occur when the Earth passes through the dust left behind by comets, usually by recurring short-period ones. Meteor showers from long-period Oort cloud comets are rare events indeed.
All right, so you get the gist of it. It's going to be history making to be sure. So you want to? There's a couple ways to do this. Now you can use a video camera, and you can set it up on a tripod, and you can film Ison while making some comments out in the street at night for your dark sky event, or you can get some night vision goggles. And you can put the night vision goggles, hold them over the front of your video camera and film through the night vision goggles. And then you can really see the detail of Comet Ison. I've done this before. Even holding it, you know, by hand is not all that difficult, as long as you don't zoom in really, really tight on it where the field of view gets so small that it's hard for you to hold it steady. I've actually filmed the International Space Station coming over with the Russian supply ship close behind it using night vision goggles and a video camera. It works out pretty well. You get the hang of it after just a few seconds of doing it. All right, let's move on. We've got another subject matter. I'm a little young to remember this, but I remember my parents telling me about this, and we also still have it active. If you manage to get overseas and tune it in on your radio, now you can still tune it in on ham bands, but this actually works on the public radio waves overseas. For decades, a so-called anti-propaganda law prevented the U.S. government's mammoth broadcasting arm from delivering programming to American audiences. Now, we have done it overseas for many, many decades. We call it, it is propaganda, but it is designed to sow unrest and distrust for governments that either oppress their people or oppose government or American ideals. We use it, and you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. But on July 2nd, just a couple of weeks ago, that came silently to an end. Of course, unless you're an X Squared Radio listener, then you're going to hear about it right now. Because there was the implementation of a new reform passed in January. The result, an unleashing of thousands of hours per week of government-funded propaganda radio and TV programs for domestic U.S. consumption in a reform initially criticized as a green light for U.S. domestic propaganda efforts. So what just happened? That's a really good question. Until this month, a vast ocean of U.S. programming produced by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, such as Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Middle East Broadcasting Networks. Ever hear of those? Well, they could certainly only be viewed or listened to at broadcast quality in foreign countries. The programming varies in tone and quality, but its breadth is vast. It's viewed in more than 100 countries in 61 languages. The topics covered include human rights abuses in Iran, self-immolation in Tibet, human trafficking across Asia, and on-the-ground reporting in Egypt and Iraq. The idea is to keep the people of those countries informed as to what's really going on behind their governments, what's really happening, so that they don't buy into the party line, the thing that's spewed at them 24 hours a day through the loudspeakers in the streets and on their radio stations and on their TV stations. The restriction of these broadcasts was due to the Smith-Mund Act, a long-standing piece of legislation that has been amended numerous times over the years, perhaps most consequentially by Arkansas Senator J. William Fulbright in the 70s. Fulbright was no friend of Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and moved to restrict them from domestic distribution, saying they should be given the opportunity to take their rightful place in the graveyard of Cold War relics. Fulbright's amendment to Smith-Mund was bolstered in 1985 by Nebraska Senator Edward Zorinsky, who argued that such propaganda should be kept out of America as to distinguish the U.S. from the Soviet Union, where domestic propaganda is a principal government activity. It also goes on all the time in Iran and in Egypt and also in Israel. Zorinsky and Fulbright sold their amendments on sensible rhetoric. American taxpayers shouldn't be funding propaganda for American audiences. So did Congress. Just tear down the American public's last defense against domestic propaganda? Are we getting deluged with American propaganda? Do we see that 24 hours a day on many of the cable and network news stations and PSA outlets? Well, you might say yes. You might say no. I'm sure you think your favorite news station doesn't spew propaganda at you. But you may think that competitive news stations, ones that you don't listen to, do spew propaganda 24 hours a day. Some people listen to MSNBC and swear by it. Other people listen to Fox News or NBC or 2020 or 60 Minutes and they swear by it. So what's propaganda and what isn't? If you have an idea, you've got some thoughts on this, you can call me at 888-429-5471 and we can talk about it. I'll even take the outside of country comments, 530-413-9537. Let's have an open dialogue about it because, you know, we think about news broadcasting as trying to inform us, give us enough information so that we can vote right, so that we can spend our money correctly, so that we know where to invest, so we know where to travel and also where to take our vacations in the summertime. That's what we rely on the news for. Where do we position ourselves? How do we get out of the way of one behemoth or another slamming its way through the China shop of our society? That's what we rely on the news for. But propaganda is something else. Propaganda is rhetoric. Rhetoric is salesmanship. It's the ability to put language together that you recognize in your culture, in your culture. And believe me, in the United States, we have lots of cultures. We are a country of multiple cultures. Go to Baltimore, go to Atlanta, go to Los Angeles. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Inside each of these massive cities, you have subcultures. You have Arab subcultures. You have Chinese subcultures. You have Italian and Irish and even Lithuanian and all kinds of different subcultures inside of there. And so each one of those has an idiosyncratic theme that they like listening to. That's why they call themselves Irish Americans. That's why they call themselves African Americans or Israeli Americans, because they have this theme, this banner, this tribal flag that they fly, so to speak, above their turf inside our country. They're allowed to. It's part of what makes us so diverse and so amazing as a country. But when one theme begins to broadcast their ideals into another neighborhood, that's called propaganda. When you start saying to a subculture inside a main culture that this is wrong, or you're being treated unfairly, or we're being treated unfairly, and so you should come to our rescue, that's propaganda. And I think that hardly any of you would believe for a minute that at least at some time during the day, you don't hear some of this Felder garb. When you're listening to talk radio during the day, or when you're listening to the weather on the television while you're getting breakfast ready, getting the kids ready for school, you're going to hear it. But the beauty about this is that most intelligent people can say, ah, that's just propaganda. We let it go in one ear and out the other. But if it's skillful enough, if it's done well enough, if it pushes the buttons well enough, if it rouses our faculties to the point where we go, yeah, what about that? Then it has been successful. BBG's spokeswoman, Lynn Whale, or Whale, insists BBG is not a propaganda outlet. Of course she would say that. And its flagship services, such as Voice of America, present fair and accurate news. Well, I don't know if you've traveled much, Earth Explorers. I haven't traveled a whole lot, but I've traveled enough and worked in enough foreign countries, Japan and China and Egypt, and I've been in Tibet, although I didn't watch much TV when I was there. And I've heard CNN in those foreign countries. It's not the same CNN you see on the TV here, not the one out of Atlanta. This is the one out of London, or this is the one out of Hong Kong. When you listen to that CNN, America is the worst country in the world. We're the biggest polluters. We're the biggest gluttons. We're greedy. We are imperialists. We step on other countries' rights. We mess with their governmental systems by sanctioning them or bribing groups that are against the government that happens to have a different point of view on commerce and maybe other rights as America. You hear a totally different story. And if you're American, by the time you leave there, you're damaged. Oh, you may say, you know what, I really can't stand watching the news because they tear our country down every day. But I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, Earth Explorers, no matter how well-trenched you are in your creed about who you are, what kind of American you are, what kind of ideals and theme you have relative to your banner. That is to say, if you are a conservative or a liberal or a libertarian, if you think government should run everything and be everything, or if you think government should be nothing and out of sight, out of mind, and only should be involved with when it's absolutely necessary and only inside the parentheses of the Constitution, well, believe me, you're going to be damaged goods when you come home. Couple things are going to happen, and I'll explain that toward the end of this article. She goes on to say, they don't shy away from stories that don't shed the best light on the United States, she told the cable. She pointed to the charters of Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. Quote, our journalists provide what many people cannot get locally, uncensored news, responsible discussion, and open debate. Close quote. Well, I've listened to some of that and some of the news broadcasts over there. And as far as I'm concerned, and I have a pretty open and accepting theme about me, not much discussion goes on. Certainly not much debate goes on. And as to whether it's uncensored, no argument here. It's definitely not censored. Is it responsible? Well, think of it like this. You have a glass of warm water and you're dropping ice cubes into it. Now, are the ice cubes the same as the water? Well, chemically speaking, they are, but physically they're not. What is going to happen is that ice is going to melt. That message is going to get diluted, but the water is going to get colder. You're going to change. You're going to come home to America, and the next time you hear the news, or the next time you hear our version, or should I say, the newscaster's version of what went on with some military or some government or some economic move, there's going to be a little doubt in the back of your mind. Wait a minute. What if my government isn't telling me the truth? What if that perspective that I got when I was in London, or that perspective I got when I was in Beijing, or that perspective I got when I was in Rio and I listened to the news, what if that perspective is a little bit right? What if our government isn't really telling us the truth? You see, a former U.S. government source with knowledge of the BBG says the organization is no Pravda, but it does advance U.S. interests in more subtle ways. In Somalia, for instance, Voice of America serves as counter-programming to outlets peddling anti-American or jihadist sentiment. Somalis have three options for news, the source said, word of mouth, Al-Shabaab, or Voice of America Somalia. There you have it. You have the glass of warm water, you have the ice cube, and you have the glass. Put the three together, and you're going to get a little bit different physical properties. This partially explains the push to allow BBG broadcasters on local radio stations inside the United States. The agency wants to reach diaspora communities, such as St. Paul, Minnesota's significant Somali expatriate community. How about Detroit's Little Baghdad? How about Baltimore's Libyan population? You see, those people can get Al-Shabaab. They can get Russia Today, but they couldn't get access to their taxpayer-funded news source like Voice of America Somalia in their language, the source said. It was silly. Lynn added that the reform has a transparency benefit as well. Now Americans will be able to know more about what they are paying for with their tax dollars. Greater transparency is a win-win for all involved, she said. And so, with that, we have the Smith-Mund Modernization Act of 2012, which passed as part of the 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, and it went into effect this month. But if anyone needed a reminder of the dangers of domestic propaganda efforts, the past 12 months provided ample reasons. Last year, two USA Today journalists were ensnared in a propaganda campaign after reporting about millions of dollars in back taxes owed by the Pentagon's top propaganda contractor in Afghanistan. Eventually, one of the co-owners of the firm confessed to creating phony websites and Twitter accounts to smear the journalists anonymously. Additionally, just this month, the Washington Post exposed a counter-propaganda program by the Pentagon that recommended posting comments on a U.S. website run by a Somali expatriate with readers opposing al-Shabaab. Today, the military is more focused on manipulating news and commentary on the internet, especially social media, by posting material and images without necessarily claiming ownership, reported the Post. But for BBG officials, the references to Pentagon propaganda reports are nauseating, particularly because the Smith-Mund Act never had anything to do with regulating the Pentagon, a fact that was misunderstood in media reports in the run-up to the passage of the new Smith-Mund reforms in January. Here's an example. It included a report by the late BuzzFeed reporter Michael Hastings. We talked about Michael Hastings a couple of weeks ago on this program. This is the individual that had discovered something quite nasty, and he was about to report on it. And he tweeted to his friends, "I'm being investigated by the FBI. I need to go off the radar for a while." 2 hours later, his Mercedes-Benz almost smashed head-on into a palm tree in Santa Monica, California. I say almost because the car exploded into a flaming ball of fire, spewing the motor backwards out of the car before it struck the tree. There were no survivors. We talked about how easy it is to cyber hack an automobile. Why is that important? Well, because a Mercedes-Benz has the most modern throttle and electronic stability control braking of any car on the road. You cannot shut the car off while you're driving it. You cannot shift it into park while you're driving it. You can't step on the brakes because the pedal in the car doesn't actually physically connect to the brakes. There's an electronic connection between the brake pedal and the brakes in the car. Once the brakes are hacked, they can either be applied remotely or they can be disabled remotely. If you press on the accelerator, we used to call it the gas pedal in the old days. Technically speaking, it's the air pedal. But now it's simply a throttle positioner. You step on it and it changes electronic values, which the computer interprets as your desire to accelerate or decelerate the vehicle. Those signals are then sent to a computer. The computer analyzes what you want to do with the vehicle and changes the fuel mixture and the throttle position inside the throttle body to make the vehicle go faster, maintain speed, or slow down. All of that can easily be hacked. How do I know that? Well, why don't you just take your car down to the local AutoZone and ask them to tap into your computer system and tell you if you have any codes on your system. He will take out about a $20 remote control, plug it into your portal on your car, and he'll have ready access to all the database records in your vehicle. He can clear those records. With just a little bit more authority, he can change the settings on your car. Have you ever heard of a car being chipped? You know what that means? No, it's not a piece of gravel that flies up off the road and chips the paint. That computer has a series of chips in it. Those chips are EEPROMs. That is to say, they're electronic memory chips. They hold a program that's been written on them. If you take that chip out and you put another chip in the car, it changes the driving characteristics of the car. For instance, let's say you drive a big SUV or a truck or a small SUV. When you accelerate, you'll notice as you're accelerating up through 1,000, 2,000 RPM, everything's pretty well controllable. You get to 3,000 RPM, that vehicle takes on a whole life of its own. You say, oh my gosh, where'd that extra 100 cubic inches of power come from? That's because most fuel management systems change the fuel ratio every 1,000 RPM. Every 1,000 RPM from 1,000 to 2,000 to 3,000. Once you hit 3,000 RPM, the ratio between gasoline and air changes, allowing the vehicle to become much profoundly more powerful. It's a big difference between 2,000, 2,500, 2,800, and 3,000. Once you hit 3,000, it's a whole different beast. You can change that chip out so that the fuel-air ratio is changed every 100 RPM instead of every 1,000 RPM. Now, you're going to use more fuel, but you're going to have a way more fun vehicle to drive. So, and there's also things like not only the electronic stability control, but the electronic traction control. You remember the good old days when you used to be able to romp down on that accelerator and smoke the rear tires off, drift the car sideways around a corner? Well, those days are gone because the electronic traction control senses when one of the wheels breaks loose and says, oh my goodness, you're losing control. I need to take control of the settings of your accelerator in order to keep your tires firmly connected to the road. Your mind, you're saying, no, I want my tires to break loose. Get out of my way. But, of course, the control system won't allow you to do that unless you have a button in the car, like you have a Corvette or something, where you can stick a key in and disable the traction control. Most vehicles, especially SUVs, you are not allowed to do that. But if you hack that vehicle can be driven straight into a wall at 100 miles an hour, and there's nothing you can do about it except crawl out the window or jump out the sunroof. And if you're willing to do that at 100 miles an hour to try to spare your life, well, I would say that you're not Michael Hastings, because he didn't try to do that either, and he was instantly killed. Now, the BuzzFeed reporter Michael Hastings, who suggested that the Smith-Mund Modernization Act would open the door to the folks down at Wars R Us pumping propaganda to U.S. audiences. In fact, as amended in 1987, the act only covers portions of the State Department engaged in public diplomacy abroad. Okay, that's overseas, outside the country. But the public diplomacy section of the R Bureau and the Broadcasting Board of Governors has something else to say. The news circulated regardless, much to the displeasure of Representative Mac Thornberry, Republican from Texas, a sponsor of the Smith-Mund Modernization Act of 2012. Here's what he said. To me, it's a fascinating case study in how one blogger was pretty sloppy, not understanding the issue, and then it got picked up by Politico's playbook, and you had one level of sloppiness on top of another. That's what Thornberry told the cable last May. And once something sensational gets out there, it just spreads like wildfire. That, of course, doesn't leave the BBG off the hook if its content smacks of agri-pop. Or should I say agit-prop, agitation propaganda. But now that its materials are allowed to be broadcast by local radio stations and TV networks, they won't be a complete mystery to Americans. Previously, the legislation had the effect of clouding and hiding this stuff, the former U.S. official told the cable. Now, we'll have a better sense. Gee, some of this stuff is really good, or gee, some of this stuff is really bad. At least we'll know now. Well, I have one thing to say, Mr. Thornberry. Right here on X Squared Radio, we observe this every week and we talk about it. How the population, the uninformed listener, the listener who is easily swayed, because if you perceive that somebody hates you, everything they say is perceived as hate speech. If you're convinced that someone loves you, everything they say is perceived by you as love. We see it every single day. We see leadership in this country that is perceived as loving a certain section of our demographic. And everything he says is perceived as genius or love, even though it is disemboweling their economics, destroying their families, ruining their employment chances, destroying their educational opportunities. It's seen as love. If those same things or anything close to it would come from any other source, it would be seen as wholesale genocide against that particular demographic. And we see it every single day. So this propaganda can be dangerous in the sense that you are reaching expatriate, some of them one generation current, or children of that generation. And you're reaching them in their language. And you're reaching them with their buzzwords, their way of saying things. You're reaching them as one perceived as one who loves them. And you're spreading distrust and hatred and a message of dissent for another aspect. So if it's the same message that's being broadcast overseas, and I've listened to it in English, it's the ice cube in the water, my friends. City by city, we are then feeding information into those expatriate neighborhoods, further dividing our country. We're no longer a soup. We're no longer a melting pot. We're no longer Americans. We are now nationally divided up, tribe by tribe, neighborhood by neighborhood, state by state. No good will ever come from this. The only thing that helps a nation move forward, whether you're talking about a religious message or whether you're talking a political message or even educational message, is the truth. That's the only thing that will help society. If you sow untruths, which are perceived or classified as propaganda, whether they're a loving message or a hateful message, you will see the results of those messages in your streets. I have recalled for you a couple of times sitting on the wall outside of the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. Quite a fascinating place. Not like museums that you would walk through in other places in the world, but so filled with so many artifacts that you get numb after a while. Tens of thousands of pieces, anywhere from 500 years to 5,000 years old. Just phenomenal tools and artwork and instruments, and some of it massive and some of it small. Sitting on this wall with 11 other people, the call for prayer came sometime around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was quite warm. We'd walked a lot of miles that day, shot a ton of pictures, and it was time to go back to the hotel, get something to eat, and retire for the evening. And the call for prayer came, and it is kind of a peaceful, melodic kind of poetic sound, even though I didn't understand the language. But once the prayer was over, which probably took about 5 minutes, maybe 6 minutes, another voice came on, or maybe it was the same voice, but it was a totally different tone. And I got to listening for a couple minutes, even though I couldn't understand the words, I could definitely understand the pace and the vigor. And it sounded to me like good old-fashioned Southern fire and brimstone. So I asked the our guide, who was a very sweet lady, spoke English so well and was so accommodating to us and our desire to be, you know, great white intrepid explorers, as it were. And I asked her, what is he saying? And she said, oh, he's just, you know, talking to the people, telling them some kind of message. I don't think she was really listening to it either. But then I noticed the tone get even a little more acidic, as though now he wasn't speaking in front of the mic. He was holding the mic with both hands. He was really trying to deliver something forcefully. And I said, no, seriously, just listen to his words for just 10, 15 seconds and tell me, what is he saying? I'm interested. And so she tuned her ear to it and she listened for about, less than 30 seconds, I'm sure. And then she looked down at me and the others sitting on the wall and she said, I think it's time to get back on the bus and go back to the hotel. I said, well, what is he saying? She said, no, I think it's time that we need to gather everybody up, get your things together, let's get on the bus and go back to the hotel. We didn't argue with her. 4 days later, Tahrir Square filled up with millions of people, and Mr. Mubarak was on his way out. I'm telling you that these messages coming from someone in a language that you're familiar with, that you think loves you, everything they say will be perceived as a message of love. And you may act on it. Those messages never, and I mean never, underlined, bolded, and italicized, never unify a country. Those messages are designed specifically to divide a country based upon a theme from someone else's camp. That's the message I would like to get across to you. All right. There is some sanity in these conspiracies, by the way. We do this from, you know, a philological point of view, or a chiasmatic point of view. And chiasmus is the idiosyncratic way of a single writer. That's how sometimes scriptures are analyzed, to see if it was the translator that's writing it out of his head, or if it was actually a prophet of old based on a language style. It's chiasmus. It's a scientific way of analyzing language. If we look at this from this point of view, this using this methodology, you can understand what's going on. You listen to this program, you can be aware that your government, our government, is not always telling us the truth. Does that bother us a lot? Yeah, well, yes, sometimes it does. But does it really serve to divide us? Does it really serve to bring us under a tribal banner, where we're willing to pick up an axe and charge across the frozen tundra at our neighbors? No, not really. It makes us more critical thinkers. It makes us see through doublespeak, political felder garb that's told to us, yes, we're going to put together a comprehensive committee and we promise a thorough investigation and a special prosecutor. Well, come on, people, you've listened to this program enough and others enough, you know what that means. That means we have a brand spanking new broom, and we're going to lift up the carpet, and we're going to sweep this right under it, and you're never going to hear from this again. That's what that means. But we already know that. That's not language that's designed to sow distrust and to break up and align a government in a different way. Propaganda is designed to do that. It is designed to fight other propaganda services, whether they come from the government in that country or from others. Russia does the same thing. China does the same thing. And the Middle Eastern factions do exactly the same thing. So you see what I'm talking about. But there are more sane conspiracies here. Recent studies by psychologists and social scientists in the U.S. and U.K. suggest that contrary to mainstream media stereotypes, those labeled conspiracy theorists appear to be saner than those who accept the official versions of contested events. Critical thinking skills, in other words. That's what we're trying to reach here. These critical thinking skills are important. Without them, then you become, you fall prey to any wind of doctrine. The most recent study that I'm reciting here was published on July 8th of this year by psychologists Michael J. Wood and Karen M. Douglas of the University of Kent, entitled, What About Building 7? You remember the Building 7 in New York? It's a social psychological study of online discussion of 9/11 conspiracy theories. The study compared conspiracist, pro-conspiracy theory, and conventionalist, anti-conspiracy comments at news websites. Now, the authors were surprised to discover that it is now more conventional to leave so-called conspiracist comments than conventionalist ones. Of the 2,174 comments collected, that's a pretty good sampling, wouldn't you say? 1,459 were coded as conspiracist and 715 as conventionalist. That's a little bit weighted one way or the other, but let's hear it out. In other words, among people who comment on news articles, those who disbelieve government accounts of such events as 9/11 and the JFK assassination outnumber believers by more than 2-1. That's a pretty good statistic. If you're randomly going to sources that record comments, it could be that the number of sites available that would record comments are more conspiracist than conventionalist. That could account for the numbers. But let's just take it at face value. That means it is the pro-conspiracy commenters who are expressing what is now the conventional wisdom, while the anti-conspiracy commenters, the conventionalists, are becoming a small, beleaguered minority. Well, many people would say that's a good thing. Perhaps because their supposedly mainstream views no longer represent the majority, the anti-conspiracy commenters often displayed anger and hostility. Yeah, when you're outnumbered, well, then you have to get loud. The research showed that people who favored the official account of 9/11 were generally more hostile when trying to persuade their rivals. Additionally, it turned out that the anti-conspiracy people were not only hostile, but fanatically attached to their own conspiracy theories as well. According to them, their own theory of 9/11, a conspiracy theory holding that 19 Arabs, none of whom could fly planes with any proficiency, pulled off the crime of the century under the direction of a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan, was indisputably true. So what's your problem with that? A lot of people would say. The so-called conspiracists, on the other hand, did not pretend to have a theory that completely explained the events of 9/11. In other words, we don't really have a plan or can explain exactly how they did it. But for people who think 9/11 was a government conspiracy, the focus is not on promoting a specific rival theory, but in simply trying to debunk the official account, saying things like, look, this just doesn't make sense. Look at the evidence, it doesn't make sense. And if you can get a non-conspiracist, a conventionalist, to lay down his American flag and lay down his musket for just a minute and listen, you might get somewhere. In short, The new study by Wood and Douglas suggests that the negative stereotype of the conspiracy theorist, a hostile fanatic wedded to the truth of his own inner fringe theory, accurately describes the people who defend the official account of 9/11, not those who dispute it. Additionally, the study found that so-called conspiracists discuss historical context, such as viewing the JFK assassination as a precedent for 9/11, more than anti-conspiracists. It also found that the so-called conspiracists do not like to be called conspiracists or conspiracy theorists. That's true. Critical thinking is not conspiracy theory. Most of these findings are amplified in the new book, Conspiracy Theory in America, by political scientist Lance DeHaven Smith, published earlier this year by the University of Texas Press. Professor DeHaven Smith explains why people don't like being called conspiracy theorists. The term was invented and put into wide circulation by our good friends down at the CIA to smear and defame people questioning the JFK assassination. The CIA's campaign, propaganda, to popularize the term conspiracy theory and make conspiracy belief a target of ridicule and hostility must be credited, unfortunately, with being one of the most successful propaganda initiatives of all time. It's true. It's true. If you're labeled a conspiracy theorist in your workplace, nothing you say will be believed by anyone who's a conventionalist. In other words, people who use the terms conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist as an insult are doing so as the result of a well-documented, undisputed, historically real conspiracy by the CIA to cover up the JFK assassination. At the time of the JFK assassination, there were not thousands. There were hundreds of thousands of people that knew beyond the shadow of any doubt that there was more than one shooter that took out the president. And that's why the CIA was employed. Let's come up with a term that we can label these people with so no one will believe them. Have we done that since then? Have you ever heard the term birther? I'll bet you have. Anybody who questions the validity of the birth certificate, Social Security record, Selective Service record of the President of the United States is labeled a birther. I've heard it myself right on national news. I've heard it myself from friends that I have that I try to discuss it with. Hey, what about this evidence? What about that evidence? Oh, you're just a birther. That campaign, by the way, was completely illegal, against the law, and the CIA officers involved were criminals. The CIA is barred from all domestic activities and yet routinely breaks the law to conduct domestic operations ranging from propaganda to, yes, I'm afraid it's true, assassinations. De Havilland Smith also explains why those who doubt official explanations of high crimes are eager to discuss historical context. He points out that a very large number of conspiracy claims have turned out to be true, and there appears to be strong relationships between many as yet unsolved state crimes against democracy. An obvious example is the link between the JFK and RFK assassinations. Wait a minute. If there was just one shooter, and you'll remember that shooter was assassinated himself, how could he be involved in the RFK assassination? Both paved the way for presidencies that continued the Vietnam War. According to DeHaven Smith, we should always discuss the Kennedy assassinations in the plural, because the two killings appear to have been aspects of the same larger crime. Bingo. Conspiracy theory, my butt. Psychologist Lori Manuel of the University of Guelph agrees that the CIA-designed conspiracy theory label impedes cognitive function. She points out in an article published in American Behavioral Scientist in 2010 that anti-conspiracy, those are conventionalists, people are unable to think clearly about such apparent state crimes against democracy as 9/11 due to their inability to process information that conflicts with pre-existing belief. See, once you step outside the box, once you say, well, somebody in the government was involved, or this was an inside job, or there's evidence of high explosives being put into the two towers, or maybe three buildings, like Building 7, but also being detonated at the precise time. Their ears close, their foot stomps on the ground, they start screaming and walking in a blind circle because they don't want to hear it. That's the inability to process information that conflicts with pre-existing belief. In the same issue of American Behavioral Scientist, University of Buffalo professor Stephen Hoffman adds that anti-conspiracy people are typically prey to strong confirmation bias. That is, they seek out information that confirms their pre-existing beliefs while using irrational mechanisms such as the conspiracy theory label to avoid conflicting information. That's a fancy way of saying, I'm only going to listen to what my preacher tells me. If this source comes from any other source, like those pesky Methodists down the street, I'm not listening to a thing they say. That is called confirmation bias. It's called prejudice. It's where you say, now wait a minute, I have a very strong theory that it was 19 Arabs who didn't know crap from Shinola that were able to take jetliners with people on it, successfully take over all of them and fly them into a building with almost no formal training with an aircraft that size, and smash them into those buildings, and that the fuel burning in the stairwells of those buildings weakened them to the point where they both collapsed within minutes of each other. And if it doesn't fit inside that range of ideas, A, I'm either not willing to listen to it, or, wait a minute, you said what? Everybody that worked for this company or that company got a phone call the night before, don't come into work? The office is going to be closed? What do you mean closed? It's never closed. It's open 24 hours a day. What do you mean the gold was moved out of the basement the day before this happened? What does that mean? What are you trying to tell me? What do you mean? This coincidence, that coincidence, one after the other after the other. Now you're starting into critical thinking. Now you're not displaying confirmation bias. Now you're doing cognitive and clear thinking about these processes. The extreme irrationality of those who attack conspiracy theories has been ably exposed by the communications professors Gina Husting and Martin Orr of Boise State University in a 2007 peer-reviewed article entitled Dangerous Machinery, Conspiracy Theorist as a Transpersonal Strategy of Exclusion. They wrote, if I call you a conspiracy theorist, it matters little whether you actually claimed that a conspiracy exists or whether you have simply raised an issue that I would rather avoid. By labeling you, I strategically exclude you from the sphere where public speech, debate, and conflict occur. I'll give you another example. If I call you on national news a birther, it matters little whether you have actually claimed that a conspiracy exists, or whether you have some kind of proof that a document or more documents than one have been forged or are mysteriously missing. By labeling you, I strategically exclude you from the sphere where anyone is going to listen to a darn thing you have to say. I don't care if you're a sheriff or if you're a former governor or if you're one of the wealthiest people in the world. You are going to be obfuscated publicly, and no one is going to listen to a thing you say. But now, thanks to the internet and live talk radio like X Squared Radio, people who doubt official stories are no longer excluded from public conversation. The CIA's 44-year-old campaign to stifle debate using the conspiracy theory smear is nearly worn out. Oh, they're coming up with new terms all the time, though, I can tell you that. Birther is alive and well. In academic studies, as in comments on news articles, pro-conspiracy voices are now more numerous, and they're more rational than the anti-conspiracy ones. No wonder the anti-conspiracy people are sounding more and more like a bunch of hostile, paranoid cranks. And that's not a CIA label. All right, let's take a quick break. We ran just a skunch over, but I wanted to keep that point salient while we move through into the next article. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio. We'll be right back after a short musical interlude. Take it easy. X Squared Radio, second hour, July 21st, 2013. Our AccuWeather window forecast is about 81 degrees and rainy outside. 23 of the last 25 days it's rained. Kind of odd for North Carolina. I'm sure you're experiencing odd weather where you are as well. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. We've got a little bit of lightning here and there, so if our power goes out, you'll know exactly what's going on. Our phone number live anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Give us a call. This hour, we're going to talk about the strangeness of weather, what's going on, who's at fault for it, what's being said out there. Anywhere on planet or off planet, if you want to reach us, you can at 530-413-9537. And we would most appreciate your phone call, where I'm as friendly as I can be. Those of you that have listened to the more than 2,000 hours we have archived, either at bbsradio.com or at X Squared Radio, can attest to the fact that we rarely confront here, much as some of you would like me to do that. My purpose is to get them to tell their complete story. And in that philosophy, I have been successful with over 200 of the world's finest authors. Last month we had Diana West on the program and her great book, American Betrayal, about a de facto coup d'etat from the Soviets during World War II, and how the much beloved Roosevelt White House was completely compromised, much to the chagrin of over 15,000 Americans and several European prisoners of war who finished up not the war, but their lives in Soviet gulags because two presidents, at the behest of Soviet spies who were working inside our government, would not allow them to even recognize that those prisoners of war existed, let alone go get them. I highly recommend the book. I highly recommend the author. And I even more highly recommend that you go back and listen to that interview, because she has been interviewed all over the place, even on C-SPAN's Book TV. And in her own words, and in the words of several of her loyal readers, their favorite interview was right here on X Squared Radio. So, I will treat you the same way. Come on, let's talk about it. A lot of people realize at this point, because I think the handwriting is on the wall, the banner is flying behind the airplane over every major city in the country, as it were, that the biggest enemy to civilized man today is the dreaded carbon dioxide. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, I'm absolutely convinced of it, that CO2 is going to be the death of us all. Everybody knows that it's poisonous, right? I was in a meeting one time, and it was a management review meeting, and the environmental guy was making a report that we had the dreaded carbon tetrachloride in our maintenance shop. Now, one of the reasons we use this, it's, by the way, just an active ingredient, is we use it to clean aluminum so that when we heliarc the aluminum, we don't get black specks in it, because we really want it to make nice-looking tools. And so the the environmental guy said, we need to get rid of this carbon tetrachloride because it's poisonous. And the plant manager, she has said, absolutely, I totally agree. We need to get all the chlorides out of this plant immediately. And of course, I was getting ready to speak on my piece, but I couldn't help myself. I said, pass the salt over here. So somebody passed the salt over, and I threw it in the garbage. He said, what are you doing? I said, sodium chloride. You said get all the chlorides out of the building. Sodium chloride's table salt. That's how ridiculous his phobia for chlorides because of this erroneous report. Carbon tetrachloride had been in that plant for 25 years. No one had ever been damaged by it. And by the way, once we got rid of it, we never made a decent aluminum joint again. Hey, let's go to the phones. I think we've got Mona on the line. Welcome to the program, Mona.
Brooks, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I just couldn't wait to hear your voice.
Right. And with you, I've been it would work. We were having a little trouble before I got on, but you can hear me now, right?
Yeah, it's a little hit and miss, but I'm getting the gist of it. You know, I'm so amazed that we can talk to people from Australia to Oregon to wherever, and we can have a live conversation and the whole world can listen to us. So just talk slowly and naturally, and I'm sure that we'll make our way through it.
Okay. I want to talk about that was in your first segment. You were into propaganda.
Yes, I was talking about propaganda and how it has been effectively used for a long, long time. Radio Free America has been around for 50 years plus, and
right.
Some of America has used it effectively.
If you would speak to the usage of the electromagnetics, TVs and other sound mediums, get off the internet, or a television set, or whatever. How they use the electromagnetic energy to compound the propaganda and shove it into brains so that they really can't think any other way.
Oh, you're making a very effective point there. We used to think that just the repeating of the message over and over and over again, your government is bad and they're not here to help you kind of message. But we are, and we'll be happy to send you weapons so that you can overthrow them. That used to be enough, but you're right. Now we're adding on top of that involuntary invasion into their own psyche by using subsonics, even ELF and HLF and UHF waves that are electronically put into their area where they're bathed with it all the time. And so it either puts them to sleep or creates an anxiety, but it associates the message that they're hearing with their ears with the feeling they have in their brain or in their bodies, and it conditions them to take action.
Is it possible to cause, say, two people in the same room to cause it two separate feelings or thoughts, like one is feeling very happy and they're making feel very dull, sad? Is that possible?
No, I don't really think it's possible, because I don't think that the waves can differentiate for physiology. I think the waves are going to be sort of a one-size-fits-all either anxiety wave or a soma wave, as it were. And some people are going to be more sensitive to it than others, and some people are going to be more cognizant that, hey, wait a minute, something's going on outside of me that's trying to influence me, and they're going to be able to override it with their own sovereignty, although I don't know many people like that. But I really don't think it's possible for one person to get one feeling and another person to get another feeling from the same signal.
Even with nanobiology and compounding possibly ARP or wave frequencies, the smart meters or the towers that they put all of this receiver.
Well, now you bring in an interesting parameter to this. By the way, let me try to explain to the listeners what a nanobot is. What the body works on a lot of times are enzymes or hormones in the body. These are macromolecules, big molecules that the body builds with different systems, endocrine system and different glands in the body that make these things. Nanobots mimic those. They're little teeny tiny molecules that are artificially made that mimic these kinds of hormones, and they can be put into the body either with aerosols or in food or just dusted across the ground, and eventually you'll be absorbed with them. Now, once they're inside your body, they can be activated with radio waves. And so they can release drugs into your system. They can cause a nervous shutdown, like a dopamine effect. But in order for two people to have a different effect, they both have to be affected with different nanobots. In other words, one person was inside the exposure zone and one person was not, or they were in different zones and they came together, and then you radiated them with the radio wave. Then you would get a physiological different effect from one person to the other, exposed with the same frequency. You're absolutely correct.
I have one more question for you. You know, Gilliland, I know you do because we've all been to the ranch so many times. But it's from Facebook, and it's not from James, it's from his brother Jay. I had a question on your electric hybrid trucks. I wanted to know how long you can go before to recharge. And I'll say bye and let you answer that one and go listening on the phone or on the. That's all right.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mona, for the call. The answer
you're
is
welcome.
How far can the vehicles go on a charge? The answer is it really depends on how you drive. We do our best to try to program the controller so that everybody drives the vehicle basically the same. But not everybody drives the same. Some people like to accelerate very quickly. Some people don't care about acceleration. They just want to go as far as they can on a charge. But the bottom line is that we have designed the vehicles to go at least 100 miles on a charge with, on almost any kind of driving condition. Now, if you go out and you try to go uphill at 70 miles an hour, with 1,000 pounds in the back, I guarantee you will not go 100 miles between charges. You're gonna drain all the energy out of the battery. But you would do the same thing with a gasoline-powered car that has a posted 24 miles per gallon in the window. If you load it down and drive at 70 miles an hour uphill, you're going to get about 13 or 12 miles of the gallon. Are you going to go back to the dealer and say, hey, wait a minute, dude, I didn't get 24, I got 13 miles of the gallon? He's going to say, how are you driving? And that's exactly what we're going to say too. Here's why we hit that 100-mile mark. It's because with electric vehicles, there's a different philosophy, a different usage of the vehicle. You're not going to get in that vehicle in Eugene, Oregon, and drive to San Francisco. That's not what electric vehicles are made for. Anybody who's trying to market electric vehicles to do that is going to go broke. Now, that doesn't stop the propagandists with the oil companies from saying, what do you want that electric vehicle for? You can't jump in it at Eugene and drive to San Francisco, can you? No. Then what good is it? That's the propaganda, just trying to tear the system down. Nobody drives that way 90% of the time. 90% of the time, that vehicle is used for short trips, 10 or 11 miles one way and back. The difference is that with your gasoline-powered vehicle, you drive it until the little fuel light comes on or pretty close to it, and then you go get gas and fill it up. That's every 3, 4, 5, 7 days, right? With electric vehicles, you just plug in at the end of every day or in between trips. It's just a slightly different philosophy. You're not gassing up once a week. You're gassing up every day. That's the only difference. That, and of course, you're saving about $5,000 a year in fuel. Let's go back to the phone. Scott from Daytona, welcome back to X Squared Radio. How are you?
Good, Dr. Brooks. Good to talk to you again. I wanted to share my concern for the oxygen level on our planet. I'm living in Daytona, and I started working in Melbourne about 2 months ago, and drive every day back and forth, which is about an hour and 45 minutes. And along the way, there are several pockets of highly toxic areas where at one time, pristine areas like New Smyrna Beach, have become toxic near along Highway 95, and not to mention an almost daily occurrence of breathing in toxins as I pass by the Men's Titusville Cocoa Beach area, where there is an FPL plant, I believe, that's spewing out all sorts of toxins on a daily basis. Usually in the morning, it's worse than in the evening on my way home. And then I get to Melbourne to one of the offices I work at, and it smells like a sewer most of the time because there's a sewage plant right in the middle of Melbourne that's releasing this horrible stench into the air. And it's like the only area that's kind of like clean air around there that one can kind of count on is the area south of Melbourne, which is Palm Bay. And but even then, there's this thing called wind that can blow whatever in whatever direction. And in fact, during the July 4th week there, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, when we had guests in town for the race, there was a stench blowing up from Titusville because we had a very strong south-to-north wind that I noticed it when driving down 95 on Wednesday. It was in Titusville. On Thursday, it was in Edgewater, New Smyrna area, north of there. And then by Friday, it was in Daytona Beach, Norman. So it's almost to the point where I feel like we need to buckle down and have a Clean Air Act, at least for Florida. Tourism, because it is not good. Starting at Jacksonville and going south. I mean, Jacksonville has been polluted for years.
Yeah.
I
got friends in Salt Lake City, and, you know, it's surrounded by mountains. And once you get done with the day's driving up there, the air is just horrible. I mean, people have all kinds of pulmonary disease, and you'd think that a city like that would say, okay, that's it. We're switching over to electric. And the same thing with Los Angeles. I grew up there. I was doing flight training out at Burbank Airport, and we would fly out to Fox and do maneuvers and then come back. So we'd leave about 6:30 in the morning, go out to Fox and fly around, and then we'd come back to Burbank. By then, the smog from the people driving on 405 on the freeway that goes south through the Los Angeles area would come in through the pass, and I promise, Scott, I had to land on instruments several times at Burbank in broad daylight. The smog was coming in so thick, and we're breathing that. We're living in that. So the solution is in our hands. The president has issued mandate after mandate to government agencies, to municipalities. Look, guys, switch your fleets over to electric vehicles. We've got a stack of those mandates. We're going to the bank every day with them. The problem is that there is a concerted effort by other companies inside our economy to keep electric vehicles off the road at all costs, even at the cost of clean air. And that's no conspiracy theory, Scott. That's real cognitive thinking. Did we lose Scott? I guess we did. Well, it's a shame. He's a critical thinker, and we appreciate him. And I can tell you, I've been down to Florida in the Orlando area and just practically choked to death in the afternoons. The air is so polluted down there sometimes, it just blows my mind. Are you back with us, Scott?
I'm back. I don't see how tourists can tolerate, because I've been in Orlando in the Disney area, and it's been bad there too, particularly in the summertime. One can kind of feel the oxygen level when going north on northeast on I-4 a little bit once one gets back into Volusia County through there. But, you know, St. Augustine is good air for the most part, unless it blows south from Jacksonville. And then there are other areas, Sebastian, south of Brevard County, where Titusville and Melbourne, Cocoa Beach are, Cape Canaveral. That there are some areas there that are still clean, but then there's Vero Beach, where they have mounds of garbage by Highway 95 that they burn, And I'm talking about they look like hills. They're right by Highway 95. And then there's a problem in the north end of Palm Beach County now, too, where I used to live in Palm Beach, but it wasn't like it is now. There's a stench coming in the north end of the county there, which the LPGA golf course is right there in Palm Beach Garden. So, you know, I don't know what people are thinking and what, you know, if, you know, with all the people who are not working, like our retirees, if we could motivate them to do something during the day and advocate and lobby for, you know, clean air, as, you know, the Sierra Club and some of the other organizations do, then, you know, I think there could be more action taken and seriousness, because, and I've been over in Tampa, and it's been over there too, where there's stench over there, and I've heard from looking at the ratings, Pensacola, even though it's been kind of a pristine area for years, all of a sudden is becoming a toxic area also.
Well, I would, believe me, our industry would really appreciate the lobbying effort, but it's not so much lawmakers that you would have to lobby, it's the agencies. You know, we're opposed by the EPA. They require us to submit the serial number for every single chassis that we import. They require a 21 to 30-day approval period for every single chassis. You can't go into production with those kinds of restrictions. And then you have the NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, a bunch of lawyers who think they know how to build safe cars. And every 3 months, they issue another couple hundred regulations that have to do with cars, which they think are going to save lives. Black boxes, electric brakes, all kinds of cabling and labeling requirements. Each one of these labels cost us $100,000 to process and qualify for. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, and it's designed specifically to keep electric vehicles off the road. And it goes beyond that, too. I mean, you go to the National Automobile Dealers Association, it's a concerted effort coast to coast. A lot of people don't know that Tesla, who's probably one of the icons in the electric vehicle business, although he is serving a niche, a different niche than we are, he's being sued in 11 states where he is selling his cars because the National Automobile Dealers Association, NADA, you know, the yellow book that appraises all the cars, will not recognize their dealerships in those states. So they have asked the governors to ask the Departments of Motor Vehicles to sue them and kick them out of the states. And Tesla has already lost its first lawsuit. I assume they will lose the rest of the 10.
And Tesla is the vehicle right now, I've seen it, looks kind of like the Batmobile, cost $110,000. Is that the only one?
It's based on a Lotus. That's the sports car called the Roadster. And then they have a new model that's called the S. And it's more like a Chevy Volt, except it doesn't have a gasoline motor. It's about a $55,000 car. Fine-looking automobiles. Both of them are fine-looking. And they make a good automobile. They have good technology. And bless their hearts, they beat the naked short traders, and their stock is up over $120 a share, probably headed for $150. Right now they're sitting at about 155 times earnings on the market, and I say more power to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to see them win some lawsuits and for there to be some kind of Clean Air Act. And I may start a blog that, or something. I mean, I don't know if a blog is going to do anything, but as you say, you know, we need to be lobbying the government, the Tallahassee.
It's going to take governors going to the agencies and saying to them, we are not going to enforce your regulations in our state. They have to go up against the agencies. They have to sue them in court, and it's the only way to win, because the agencies are not elected. And yet they write laws, they pass taxes, they assess fees, they seize property, and they interfere with commerce nationally and internationally. And we have no representation in that government. The only way to win against the agencies, and we're seeing this right now with the IRS going up against Congress, it's an absolute joke. Those people can take the Fifth, They can say, well, he said, she said, and they will never change and never get to the bottom of it. And it's that way with every single agency, because the agencies write their own laws. It has nothing to do with Congress, and Congress can't do anything about it. Nothing. It has to come from governors.
Okay. Thank you. I'll get off now. I just wanted to let you know that, yes, I'm concerned too, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Talk to you later, Dr. Brooks.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott. Thanks for listening. Now, let's get into this CO2 in reality, because this is really an amazing article. And Scott really touched on something so powerful, because this literally, Earth Explorers, is where the rubber meets the road. And I'm not using that figuratively. I'm saying every one of you drives down the street and idles your paycheck out that exhaust pipe in the back. Every single one of you, more or less, is addicted to gasoline. You like being able to drive your car wherever you want. And when it's 110 degrees outside with 95% humidity, you love your air conditioning. And I don't blame you. I think it's wonderful technology. I can remember back in the 60s sweltering in an Oldsmobile as a little kid because we didn't have air conditioning in our car. I know the difference between driving with air conditioning and not driving with air conditioning. And when we changed away from chlorofluorocarbons, it made it harder, much harder, to keep those vehicles cool inside. But we have the technology to do it. And fortunately, electric vehicles like ours have air conditioning as well. And you can sit in a traffic jam and you can run the air conditioning all day long if you want. And you won't issue one single molecule of pollution. Not one. You won't idle a single gram of gasoline, because there isn't any in our vehicles. That air conditioning will run all day and keep you nice and cold inside that vehicle with no pollution at all. Now, a study by scientists with the U.S. Forest Service, Harvard University, and partners suggests that trees are responding to higher atmospheric carbon dioxide levels by becoming more efficient at using water. You'll know that photosynthesis is the chemical process, a magical chemical process, by which plants use water, CO2, the minerals in the ground, and sunshine to make sugar and cellulose and even sometimes fatty acids, and build up their plant material. That's what feeds the world. Everything on the planet, in one way or another, lives on grass, trees, bushes, fruits, beans, etc. It all works because of this photosynthetic process of respiration. Now, the interesting thing that we also realize about rapid growth genetics. Now, I'm not talking about old growth trees. Old growth trees don't put off oxygen, okay? They just don't. They're fully grown. They're not going to grow anymore. They just sit there. In fact, they actually put off a little carbon dioxide. But rapid growth, saplings, perennials, crops, trees that are putting out new growth, that are in the process of growing, they put out a lot of oxygen. And their genetics, because of natural selection and because their genetics, actually without changing their genetic makeup, can change the proteins that they produce based on stress in their environment. And additional CO2 and additional rainfall or additional sunshine or shade or temperature is a stress that's put into their biosphere. So trees, especially those that are in the growth phase, saplings growing to mature trees, or, you know, forests that have been clear-cut and are growing back, their genetics are being modified to adapt to the higher carbon dioxide levels in the air. They're becoming more efficient at turning it into oxygen and sugar. The study, which is entitled Increase in Forest Water Use Efficiency as Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide Concentrations Rise, that's the way you have to title scientific papers. It's called the hypothesis. What you're trying to do is state the hypothesis in the title, and then in the paper you explain your experiment or your measurements or your data to try to prove or disprove that hypothesis. So that's why those titles are kind of crazy like that. Anyway, it was published online July 10th, which was about 11 days ago, in the journal Nature. Dave Hollinger, who's a plant physiologist with the U.S. Forest Service, he's at Northern Research Station, is a co-author with the lead author, Trevor Keenan, of Harvard University, and colleagues from the Ohio State University, Indiana University, and the Institute of Meteorology and Climate in Germany. The article is available at, if you want to go to it, it's at nature.com/nature, and you can read it for yourself. Now, here's what Michael Raine says. Working with others, the Forest Service is developing knowledge that is essential to maintaining healthy, sustainable forests in a changing climate. Now, I don't think there's any doubt, certainly not among listeners of X Squared Radio, that climate change is upon us. We are breaking records during the winter. We're breaking records during the summer. We have more rainfall, less rainfall, higher temperatures, lower temperatures than we've ever seen. We're throwing the record books out the window. That, my friends, is called climate change. No, they're not going to call you a conspiracy theorist. They might call you a climatic nut job. I'm sure the CIA will come up with some kind of label for you, just for you. But anyway, Michael T. Raines, director of the Northern Research Station, says, "We are striving to be at the forefront of delivering sound climate science to the public." That's you. You're the public. Terrestrial plants remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through photosynthesis, a process that is accompanied by the loss of water vapor from the leaves. The ratio of water loss to carbon gain, or water use efficiency, is a key characteristic of ecosystem function that is central to the global cycles of water, energy, and carbon. We have a global cycle on this planet that includes the ocean, forests, crops, and a lot of the plant life that's maintained by humans throughout our cities. It's a global cycle. We rely on it. If it breaks down, the population is going to be trimmed, because you're going to have a lot of people not able to survive. Scientists analyzed direct long-term measurements of whole ecosystem carbon and water exchange and found a substantial increase in water use efficiency in temperature and boreal forests of the Northern Hemisphere over the past 2 decades. That, my friends, is profound. For trees whose lifespan is about 40 to 50 years to become a mature tree, many of these forests, these boreal forests, have been harvested 3, sometimes 4 times. In other words, they have been clear cut to the ground. New trees have been planted. Those trees have grown. They have been cut down, and they've done it 4 times. A lot of these forests are in their 4th growth period, which means of almost 200 years of forestation and forest farming. And now we're getting much better at it. We know how to do it. And it's not just because of regulations. It's not because the Sierra Club came in or the EPA came in or the Department of Interior came in. It just makes sense. Nobody clear cuts a mountain and then just leaves it to the rain to erode it like a giant mudslide without coming up with a replacement crop. People go back, the companies go back, and they plant tens of millions of trees. I personally know a man who personally planted 1 million trees, and most of those trees grew. Now, Hollinger says, "Our analysis suggests that rising atmospheric carbon dioxide is having a direct and unexpectedly strong influence on ecosystem processes and biosphere-atmosphere interactions in temperature and boreal forests." That's so profound. I cannot imagine how to explain that to you. How efficient trees are in using water has implications for ecosystem function, services, and feedbacks to the climate system. These include enhanced timber yields and improved water availability, which could partially offset the effects of future droughts. However, reduced evapotranspiration, or the combination of evaporation and plant transpiration from the land to the atmosphere, resulting from higher water use efficiency, could lead to higher air temperatures, decreased humidity, and decreased recycling of continental precipitation. That's a side effect that these plants, these trees, are changing their effect on the atmosphere itself. This could cause increased continental freshwater runoff, along with drought in parts of the world that rely on water transpired in other regions. You know, and I know, if you look up, it's kind of hard to see, but it's there. We have an atmospheric river that flows around the planet. Over your head, no matter where you live in this country, flows billions of gallons of water every day, right over your head. Now, it is in small molecular form. It hasn't coagulated together into droplets heavy enough to drop out of the air and fall as rain or snow. But in some places of the country, it is doing that. But in most of the country right now, we have a terrible drought because that atmospheric river is not dropping water in a controlled way or an expected way where it's supposed to. What we're seeing is a collision between warm air masses and what should be cold air masses, but are less cold air masses. And it's not enough to get that moisture that's trapped in the higher energy air to drop out and condense into rain. You have to have colder air to make it do that. The key word is dew, not D-O, but D-E-W. It's called the dew point. That air laden with moisture has to reach the dew point in order for the water molecules to begin to coagulate into droplets heavy enough to fall out of the air. Scientists analyzed data from 7 sites in the Midwest and the northeastern United States that are part of the Ameriflux network, including the Forest Service's Bartlett Experimental Forest in New Hampshire and the Howland Cooperating Experimental Forest in Maine, and expanded the analysis to 14 additional forested sites in temperate and boreal regions. Flux towers at these sites measure fluctuations in carbon dioxide uptake and water loss. The Northern Research Station operates flux towers at 5 experimental forests. In addition to the Bartlett and Howland forests, this work is continuing at the Silas Little Experimental Forest in New Jersey, the Marcel Experimental Forest in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and the Baltimore Long-Term Ecological Research Site. Now, I'm sorry to say that this isn't going on in North Carolina. It's not going on in Georgia. It's not going on in Mississippi or even Florida. We're not doing these experiments in those regions. I think there are 2 things that affect this. Number one is budget. How much money and grants are available to these various educational institutions to pay the staff, to put the flux towers in place, to put the computer systems in place to gather the data, and the staff to take the measurements and collect and process the samples? Those grants are available in the Northeast and the Northwest, in these boreal and temperate forests. But in the South, we all know you have to beat the wilderness back with a stick and a chainsaw. Every spring, with a little bit of rain, the South, the ground is so fertile and the temperature and humidity is just right that, you know, everything is the Everglades. So it's even if we have a drought in the South, the nighttime dew is so heavy that it is enough to water most plants and make them grow, especially the trees. Grass is the one thing that suffers, and that's because mostly its root system doesn't go deep enough to grab some of that deeper moisture. Trees, bushes, and some of the plant life that we would consider jungle-like has a very complex and far-reaching root system and is able to protect the moisture in the ground from mass evaporation. So consequently, everything from kudzu to birch trees grow like wildfire. The mission of the U.S. Forest Service is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. That's an admirable goal. That's a great mission. The agency has either a direct or indirect role in stewardship of about 80% of our nation's forests, 850 million acres, including 100 million acres of urban forests, where most Americans live. It is true, and I've heard this many, many times, and it's absolutely true. There is more standing timber in the continental United States now than there was at the time of Benjamin Franklin. I don't care if you believe it or not, it's true. We have satellite imagery to prove it. No, we didn't have satellite imagery in the time of Benjamin Franklin. But we do have one thing they didn't have. We have fire departments. When lightning causes a fire in a forest, in Benjamin Franklin's day, it burned to the sea. And nobody went out and replanted those trees. And a lot of the settlers came in, and in order to clear the forest out of the way, which they believed was the most fertile land, dummies, they would simply burn the forest out of the way. And then it was simpler to go in and turn the ashes in and then build the town or whatever it is you wanted to build in that area. It was a terrible way. It's a horrible ecological effect that we had on the nation in those days. But when a forest fire took hold in the Pacific Northwest, it burned everything because there was nobody there. There was nobody there to cut a fire trail or to drop water on or to put retardant on a fire and contain it. A 49-acre fire in Southern California would completely wipe everything out all the way to the Sierra Nevadas in the days of Benjamin Franklin. We have much more standing timber, especially in our urban areas, New York, Atlanta, Cincinnati, Nashville. There are tons of trees that are kept, planted, manicured, fertilized, treated for disease in our urban areas. We don't like living in a big slab of concrete. We like having trees up and down our streets, in our parks, and it's the way we manage our nation. And I think most of the nations that are successful do it that way. The mission of the Forest Service's Northern Research Station is to improve people's lives and help sustain the natural resources in the Northeast and Midwest through leading-edge science and effective information delivery. What I find so fascinating about this article is that they have now data to prove that trees are adapting to not only the change in water droppage, which a lot of our areas are being deluged right now, especially down here in the Southeast. We've had 23 out of the last 25 days, it's rained at least an inch. That's more rain than we ever see this time of year. Oh, yeah, in March and April we see that kind of rain, and up on and up to May. But people, it's July. I mean, we're usually trying to mow brown grass about this time of the year. People are running sprinkler systems and we're worried about water shortages. Not so this year. The water's going over the spillways everywhere from the upper Cumberland all the way down to southern Georgia. So the point is that trees are beginning to adapt to the climate change. For some reason, the genetics of the trees are becoming more efficient at processing the carbon dioxide. And, you know, they may even be adding a little bit to the global warming because of their transpiration and evapotranspiration processes. But as long as they keep taking that CO2 out of our atmosphere, turning it into clean oxygen, sugar, cellulose for their growth, I think we're going to be pretty happy. All right. This is a pretty short article. I want to go ahead and put it in. You know, I have often talked about the ancients, especially the giants, possibly using a method of what we call harmonic levitation. This is a way of using sound waves to apply them to very heavy objects to either make them light enough to push around or actually lift off the ground. And for some reason, it's reasonable to assume that those sound waves were powerful enough to lift a 2.5-ton block of granite off the ground, but not violent enough to shatter it in midair. And maybe we've thought, well, I don't know. That sounds a little crazy to me. Not really much evidence to support it. Well, now there is, in Zurich, Switzerland. 5 days ago, Swiss scientists say they've used sound to levitate substances, allowing them to be controlled and even mixed as they hover between two platforms. Now, the two platforms face each other. They're emitting high-energy sound waves toward each other, where the sound waves off the two surfaces overlap. They cancel out, and they can trap materials in place. Researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich reported Tuesday. Since the sound waves must be extremely powerful to levitate any even tiny droplets of liquid, the researchers chose ultrasound frequencies above the range of human hearing to protect the experimenters' ears as the experiments run. While acoustic levitators are not a new concept, this is the first such device capable of both moving and controlling the material being levitated, researcher Danielle Foresti said. We have total control of the acoustic field inside, he told BBC News. Moving objects, such as particles or droplets of a liquid freely in midair, makes it possible to investigate processes while avoiding any disruptive contact with a surface, which might comprise a chemical reaction or biological process, the researcher said. This method of moving levitated objects could have a wide range of possible applications, including industrial processes, Foresti said. Pretty interesting stuff, I'd say. I don't know if we'll ever be able to come up with ultrasonics at enough amplitude to be able to lift a 2.5-ton granite block, but somebody did it. I believe that. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. We'll listen to one of my favorites. One of my favorites. Remastered in 1977. It's a song called It's Late by Queen. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
To blame, but there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
Thank you.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, one of my favorite pieces from Queen. You don't hear it much on the radio. It's a little long for radio play, but it's a great song called It's Late. So just interesting stuff. By the way, what's going on today economically in America? It's kind of interesting. Detroit, which is one of my favorite places. Obviously, I've been in the automobile manufacturing business for almost three decades now, although I've gone over to the dark side making electric vehicles. All eyes are on the Motor City. A couple days ago, Friday, Governor Rick Snyder and the emergency manager, Kevin Orr. Now, the interesting thing about an emergency manager, the reason you have to have this in place is because cities and city managers are sitting on a lot of empty buildings, a lot of manufacturing buildings, office buildings. And what the city councils in those cities try to do is, obviously, they want to attract companies to come into their city and hire people. They want to put people back to work, and you can't blame them. And so what happens is they'll take a factory, which was used to make something, some car part or some automobile support industry, and they will basically sell it for a dollar. They'll call up a company who needs a building and needs some kind of capital break. And they can't loan them money because they don't have any, but they do have buildings. And so they'll sell the company the building for a dollar in exchange for that company coming in, establishing their business and forming jobs. Well, an emergency manager is put into place to keep cities from doing that. What happens is the governor allows the emergency manager to basically take ownership of all those empty buildings to assure the state that they sell the buildings for a proper market amount, so much a square foot. Why is that important? Well, it's important because the state makes property tax off those buildings. If the cities are allowed to sell the building for $100, it goes on the books at $100. And it can affect the tax rolls, essentially collapsing it like a depression. And so an emergency manager is hired to keep that from happening. Now, he is squarely in the spotlight explaining to the world why Detroit has become the largest city in U.S. history and probably the first of many to file for municipal bankruptcy. Here's what Snyder says. This is the time to say enough is enough in terms of the downward decline of Detroit. The city is basically broke. It has $18 billion in liabilities, and that's unsustainable level of debt. Orr says there is no way home from that equation. There's no amount of revenue that we could generate to try to address it. So we have to treat it in this fashion of bankruptcy. Now, while Detroit is being crushed by its massive debt and long-term liabilities, and I'll explain those in just a second, city services are suffering and have been for decades. And that is something both Snyder and Orr said this bankruptcy could change. What do I mean by that? Water treatment, trash service, police service, fire coverage, teachers, those kinds of city services. Average Detroiters will not lose any city services, but there will be some who will feel the pain. It's a tragedy for retirees who have worked long and hard for the city of Detroit, said Ed McNeil with the AFSCME. That's the other side of the equation. Detroit's unions and pension boards have been in court fighting to protect the benefits, so they say. What they're doing is they're blocking the city from filing bankruptcy. Yeah, it means the city's broke, but it's not without revenue. It does have revenue. It can fight its way out, but first it has to go through bankruptcy reorganization. Large companies do this all the time. The instant they file bankruptcy, their stock begins to climb. Why does it climb? Because in the bankruptcy, they're able to offset or set aside some of the debt structure. They can restructure the debt. And the main thing they can do is they restructure pensions and retirement benefits, union retirement benefits. Now you see where the real fight is. George Orzech is the chairman of the Detroit Police and Fire Pension Board. He said, if it comes down to a battle, it may have to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court if that's what they're going to choose. To anyone who thinks I wasn't negotiating good faith when they're suing me, I ask you to look at the context that your decision, instead of coming to the table with me, is to continually file suits against me, Orr said. They're not coming to the table to negotiate. All they're doing is kicking the can down the road. Now, here's what the governor says. Let's get Detroit on the path to being a great city again, because that's critically important to all of Michigan. Now, you have to realize that when these pensions were originally set up, some of it was done with the idea that there was going to be a never-ending stream of money coming out of the city of Detroit. Some of the organizations, firemen more than policemen, but some policemen as well, bought long-term bonds. And what those long-term bonds would do is they would earn interest over a period of time, and they would mature, say, in 10 or 20 years. That's exactly the kind of return you want in order to offset the load that would be put onto a city or a community with pensions. Some of the organizations did that. But the ones that didn't do that ran out of money because the city ran out of money. And now that the city's out of money, they're wanting to do other things with those pensions. They have to offset them. They have to sell them. They have to get people to come in and buy those debts. And that's why the city needs to go through bankruptcy reorganization. Now, Detroit once was the pride of America. At the height of Detroit's success as a city, the city was a representation of the American middle class. Okay, it was the greatest manufacturing city ever seen on this planet. Detroit made cars. They were the envy of the world. And whether the Japanese or the Germans want to claim that they make the best cars in the world, they wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for the innovation and drive of companies in Detroit. Detroit is the city that put the world on wheels. At its peak, Detroit was America's fourth largest city with more than 1.8 million people. Detroit's population losses began in the 1960s with migration to the suburbs. Then in the 1990s, Detroit fell victim to global politics, and literally, the roof caved in. By 2008, Chrysler and General Motors had filed bankruptcy and been reorganized by the federal government. It hasn't come back since. Today, almost 30% of Detroit's 140 square miles are either vacant or deserted. Detroit used to be the fourth largest city in the U.S., and now it is largely vacant or deserted. There are over 90,000 vacant lots and over 33,500 vacant houses. The city government is bulldozing entire city blocks of business buildings and residential homes. If you are the only one left on your block, you are forced to move. And if you are lucky, you'll receive $10,000 for your home. That's hardly even a thank you for a lifetime of service in that city. The median price of a home in Detroit is only $9,000. In some areas of Detroit, you can buy a house for $100. There are approximately 85,000 streetlights in Detroit, but copper thieves have stripped so much of the wiring out and sold it for scrap that many of the lights are not working, and the city simply cannot afford to run new copper. The mayor of Detroit previously announced that he will reduce the number of streetlights to almost half the existing total, down to 46,000 lights. That's a much lower light bill. Today, 60% of Detroit's children live in poverty. Not 60%. Detroit boasted the highest per capita income in the United States just 45 years ago. Today, Detroit does not have one chain supermarket left in the city. Even if you could afford to buy food, you couldn't find it. It is one of the highest murder rates in the country. Its infrastructure has been gutted. Real unemployment may be as high as 20 to 25% in some parts of the city. This is a real bad city to not be able to find a cop. And with the new cutbacks, it's really hard to find a cop because most police stations in Detroit now only are open to the public 8 hours a day. So sorry. If you have to report a crime after 5 p.m., you're going to get a recording. The globalists murdered Detroit through the various free trade agreements. You remember that giant sucking sound that Ross Perot said we would hear in 1992 when Clinton signed the NAFTA agreement into law? Well, in Detroit, it sounded like a tornado. Through NAFTA, GATT, and CAFTA, American auto manufacturers were free to ship their factories overseas in search of near slave labor markets. And they did. The passage of these free trade agreements made it possible to hire foreign slave laborers, and without the now prohibited tariffs on imports, the globalist-controlled corporations could ship slave labor-manufactured products back to the United States. You don't believe me? You think large, full-scale pickup trucks are American-made? Let me tell you, the most American-made truck in the nation is only 68% American-made. That's it. 32% of it is made in foreign countries. Tariffs used to pay our national debt. That's the constitutional way. No longer. We replaced tariffs with the income tax amendment. Those factories that are left behind in this country now pay 35%, the highest tax in the world. What manufacturer in their right mind would come back to the United States? Now, back to Detroit, which helps us understand where we, the rest of the nation, are headed. Orlando, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Houston, Cincinnati, New York. Watch Detroit. You may not live in an area of the country in which the jobs are headed overseas, unless, of course, you live in South Carolina or North Carolina or Arkansas or Arizona or California. You know, Silicon Valley doesn't make chips anymore. All those chips are made overseas. However, you have been targeted for deindustrialization through the president's cap and trade policies, which he has declared he will initiate through executive order. That means that it doesn't matter who you elected and sent to Washington as a congressman or a senator. It doesn't matter who you elected as a governor or whether you decide to serve on your city council or in one of your state boards. Executive order means one man, one policy. If you ever let Agenda 21 get a grip on your city, the result will be like Detroit and will result in abject poverty as a result of green zones, wildlands, promises of smart growth, saving the planet from global warming and economic growth inhibitors. Although those are real, the method by which they approach it is what destroys these cities and turns them into a rotting corpse. You don't know what Agenda 21 is? Go back and listen to some of the archives here at X Squared Radio. Or you can simply go down to your city council meeting. They have them. You can walk in anytime, doesn't cost any money. Sit in the back, grab a magazine, and listen. When you hear the word Agenda 21, when you hear the policies being written into law in your city that are under the Agenda 21, put your magazine down and listen close. Look for an organization such as the World Bank to loan Detroit the $18 billion it needs in order to regain temporary financial solvency. Remember, he who controls the debt controls the country. Without a viable industry to maintain the economic foundation of the city will predictably default on its future loan obligations. What follows is a glimpse into the future of all American cities as an increasing number of cities default on their rescue loans. Now, if you really want to know whether I'm telling the truth or not tonight, I want you to buy a plane ticket. I want you to fly to an airport called DTW. That's Detroit. I want you to take a cab. And then I want you to go to a local realtor office. And I want you to ask them face-to-face. Go buy them lunch. Have them take you around. Show you a few properties. Who's buying those city blocks? Who's putting up the money to take over those office buildings, those factories, those warehouses, those strip malls? I guarantee you will find Arab money, Middle Eastern money, and Chinese money. Detroit is being purchased by foreign nations, and it will soon no longer belong to the United States of America. And you could say, well, that's Detroit. Who cares about them? That's an old has-been city. You live in Atlanta inside the Beltway? Watch out. Exactly the same thing is happening there. Exactly the same thing is happening in Dallas, Fort Worth, in Houston, in Little Rock, in Oklahoma City, in Los Angeles, in Seattle. It's happening everywhere. When a political entity defaults on its loans, the lending agency takes possession of the collateral. It's called a repossession. Most often, the infrastructure is the collateral most sought after by the banks. When the banksters typically take control over a political entity, like they did in Bolivia, they will quadruple the cost of water, astronomically hike the price of utilities, and they will seize control of public transportation in order to jack up the rates to its ridership. That's poor people who can't afford a car. This is Detroit's future, and it will soon be yours as well. So goes Detroit, so goes the nation. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next summer, but it's coming your way. And there is a way to stop it. And we may have time to talk about that in another program. But it is a pointless stay of execution for the Michigan Circuit Court judge to block the bankruptcy. It must happen. The city must be allowed to reorganize its debt. It must be allowed to default on some of its obligations. Some of those people will have to find their pension elsewhere or to rely on Social Security. But there are people in Michigan that know exactly what I'm talking about. And one of them is a very longtime friend of X Squared Radio and me. And that's Diane. And she's on line one. Welcome back to the program, Diane.
Hey, Brooks. How are you?
Am I telling the truth? If I'm lying, I'm dying.
No, you're not. You're telling the truth, but it goes back further than that. It goes back to the 1960s race riots. It goes back to what was put out by the CIA. It goes back to the divide and conquer theory. And they had to go ahead, just like what they call the Dearborn, the Arab community, letting in the immigrants in to take over the cities around. Dearborn, actually, it wasn't Detroit. It was Dearborn that was the auto capital.
Okay, yes,
that's where it started. And then, of course, it flourished and the factories started up and so forth. And, yes, you're absolutely right. It is absolutely decipate, and it's Detroit's terrible. However, I have to say this. This was all part of the plan. It was all part of the plan to bring down the middle class, and the strongest middle class was here in Detroit. I was raised there. I went to school there. And, you know, I watched them bring in immigrants from all over that couldn't speak English, that couldn't, and they would work less. It wasn't NAFTA and GATT. That was the final nail in the coffin. But it started way before that. And the unions and Hoffa, and my uncle was Fitzpatrick. It went way beyond before that.
Well, I understand that the actual infrastructural causes for it were, the foundations were laid well beforehand. But I don't know that it was that well planned, because in the 60s, Detroit was enormously successful. I mean, Detroit made cars and shipped them
all over the world. Yeah, but 1967, that is when the race riot started. That was put out by the CIA and the Detroit Police Department.
Yeah, how did that happen? I mean,
didn't have anything to do with blacks against whites. It had nothing to do with that. I mean, they literally brought in SWAT teams, what we would call SWAT teams today, and they literally started that catastrophe that took place. You know, and then we had the World Series winner and the Detroit Tigers at that same time. The whole thing was a catastrophe. This was all about bringing. See, there was a middle class that was growing stronger and stronger and stronger. I mean, you take a look at Detroit. You take a look at the outskirts of the suburbs of Detroit, like Bloomfield Hills, Farmington. I mean, you know, Grosse Pointe Hills. I mean, some of the wealthiest people live in the country in those areas.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there is no manufacturing sector ever that made as much money and has accumulated as much wealth or was so interwoven into the fabric of what it is to be America than Detroit.
So who would have been the most – what group of people would have been most threatened – by what Detroit was becoming or had become and was growing stronger?
Well, I would say, if you're talking about an ideology, I would say the communists were most threatened by
it. Well, I don't think it was the communists. I think socialism is much far greater detriment to society than what communism.
Well, I was going
to
say same thing, same difference, but what I'm saying
is... Well, it is and it isn't. You got corporate. I mean, then the government starts taking over corporate, just like they did where nobody saw it when it took over the railroad. I mean, when the government comes in and takes over major corporations where there is no where there's no competition, and the government is got a stranglehold on it, it's going to go down.
Well, that's exactly what's been happening for the last 5 years. We've had government take over General Motors, take over Chrysler. The first thing that they did is they eliminated all the wealthy dealerships that were contributing to the Republican Party, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and left only Democrat ones left. And then the second thing that they did is they systematically wrote regulations to prevent any competitors from stepping into the same space.
Well, it even goes further back then. You look at Daimler. I mean, Daimler was a Nazi organization. They came in and took over Chrysler's. And then they let it go after they ate all the profits up.
So was Ford. I mean,
Ford is different.
How to manufacture. Henry Ford received a public award from Hitler, and he accepted it in his plant.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right. But that... If you go back into history and see exactly who Hitler was and exactly what took place and who Henry Ford, this whole thing, Henry Ford is still the only solvent car company in the Detroit, Michigan area.
Well, and they make a fine product. There's no question about that. But it was easy for them. All they had to do was overproduce, sit on inventory long enough to wait for Chrysler and GM to file bankruptcy, move the extra inventory to their dealerships, and seize market share. And that's exactly what they did. They took advantage of the government taking over General Motors and Chrysler.
Now, Brooks, I can tell you, living here and seeing the difference is between, as the media's been controlled, the difference between what we read and what we have read, okay, in our local news, the Free Press, the Detroit News, okay, over the years, okay, because it's a local news and there's too many people that know what's going on, okay, mm-hmm. so they can't defy that. What you get nationally is totally different than
what's
local. Oh,
absolutely.
And
but
that
I'm,
goes on I'm across the country. I don't care if it's weather, I don't care if it's politics, I don't care what it is.
I know that the Chinese and the United Arab Emirates are buying up the city.
Well, there's no doubt. Well, they're not. Yeah, they're buying up the parts of the city. Did you have you talked to William Henry about the Stargate of Detroit?
No, I haven't.
Well, you know what? I really would highly suggest that you talk to William about this. I've had two tours, one with his protege, which is Chad Stupke up in Traverse City, who did a huge study at downtown Detroit. And then William came in 2 years ago, and I did another tour there with him, both of them. And he's working on St. Louis, the Nashville, Chicago. There are many Stargates, but Detroit is a major Stargate. Downtown Detroit.
Now, I've been to the Nashville tour with him, and I found that to be just fascinating.
That was in D.C.
Yeah, it's just amazing. But I haven't been to the Detroit one, but
well,
I definitely want to go.
Have William back on, okay, along with a conference call with Chad Stupke, okay, on the Stargate of Detroit.
Okay.
There is something huge planned for Detroit. It is not gone yet.
Well, I hope not. I hope not. We're getting ready
to
move.
It's not gone yet. Trust me. Detroit will emerge like the phoenix out of the ashes.
Well, I hope so. We just signed contracts Friday to move manufacturing back up that way.
Hey, so good for you. Good for you. I can't wait to get my first electric car.
Me too. I can't wait.
Well, Bruce, it was great talking to you. But thanks, remember, this is all part of the program, the plan, until the people of this country, okay, and of free nations around the world wake up and go to a higher frequency and do not let this fear that they're trying to control us with. And that's exactly what's happening.
I agree with you. And you can take all that action locally. You don't have to go to Washington to do that. You can make the change.
No, you don't have to go anywhere. You can just stay in your own home.
Right.
But just know, accept what's happening as not a conspiracy theory. It's not a theory at all. It's a reality.
Absolutely.
It's a reality. Take that reality and don't have anything to do with it and go to something higher and say, you know what, they're not going to get away with this. There's too many of us and they're very few of them. We cannot let them get away with controlling our minds and our bodies through their technology that has been given to them through nefarious ways.
I couldn't agree more, Diane. Thank you. Thank you so much for the call. I'm so
glad.
All right.
Have a great evening, and thanks for your shows.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. That was Diane from Detroit, and she speaks plain to the point, and she's absolutely correct. And what you're watching right now on the national press, you're watching Mr. Orr, and you're watching the governor of Detroit, and they are right there on the front battle lines. And all you have to do is look at their faces and listen to their words, and you know they're telling the truth. All right, speaking of the truth, a few days ago, and actually a couple programs ago, I raised the question of why none of the Benghazi survivors, and I'm not talking about the people here in this country, I'm talking about the people that were inside the walls or at the annex in Benghazi when this whole thing went down. They got smoke on their clothes. They were there. They saw what went on. They survived it. Some of them were injured. They've been in the hospital off and on for 8 or 9 months. But I'll tell you where they haven't been. They haven't been to Congress. They haven't been in front of a microphone. Most people don't even know what their names are. And I raised the question why none of them, whether State Department, CIA, private security contract employees, have testified publicly before Congress. According to trusted sources, Many, if not all, of the survivors of the Benghazi attacks, along with others in the Department of Defense, the CIA, have been asked or ordered to sign additional non-disclosure agreements about their involvement in the Benghazi attacks. They have signed contracts forbidding them to talk about what went on inside those walls. Some of these new NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, we have learned were signed as recently as this summer, like a month ago. It's worth nothing that the Marine Corps Times yesterday reported that the Marine colonel whose task force was responsible for special operations in northern and western Africa at the time of the attack is still on active duty despite claims that he retired and therefore could not be forced to testify before Congress. If these reports are accurate, this would be a stunning revelation to any member of Congress. Any member of Congress that finds this out, and also, more importantly, to the American people. It also raises serious concerns about the priority of the administration's efforts to silence those with knowledge of the Benghazi attack in response. So today I ask, how many federal employees, military personnel, or contractors have been asked to sign additional non-disclosure agreements by each agency? And do these non-disclosure agreements apply to those undercover or have non-covert State Department and Defense Department employees? I do not expect the Obama administration to be forthcoming with the answers. But if this Congress does not ask for the information and compel its delivery, the American people will never learn the truth. And I think this needs to happen tomorrow morning. Every single day that they wait is another sweep of the broom and a lift of the carpet. These people get older, their memories get more foggy, they move away, their families are made offers they can't refuse. And every single day, the truth drifts off into the shadows as the batteries to the camera lights begin to go dim. Any federal employee or contractor who has been coerced and is silenced through a non-disclosure agreement should expect that Congress will ask to speak out on their behalf and compel their voice to be heard. They're out there. You know who you are. Well, this is a developing story, and I'm going to cover it anyway. Top NSA and Department of Justice officials have now... Oh, I'm sorry. This is not a developing story. It is a satire, so I'm not going to share it with you because I only have a few minutes left, and I don't want to get into it. On a new... vein, a new old virus has been found. Yeah, a new old virus. Scientists have found a new virus thought to be the biggest ever seen on Earth. I don't mean the most populous. I mean the largest. The virus, dubbed Pandora virus, is 1 micrometer big. That's up to 10 times the size of other viruses, and only 6% of its genes resemble anything ever seen on Earth before. This has led French researchers to believe the virus may have come from an ancient time or even another planet such as Mars. Pandora virus lives underwater and was found off the coast of Chile and in a pond in Australia. It is thought to have emerged from a new ancestral cellular type that no longer exists. Could have been sequestered somewhere deep beneath the earth. Real quick, I think we have Diane's got one more comment. What's up, Diane? No. Okay. Sorry. It was another note. Oh, I love live radio. It's so good. One of my favorite listeners says Benghazi is a distraction. What else is there? What's going to affect my rights? That's important. Well, yes, it is, in a sense, a distraction. But when you think about what went on in Benghazi, we're talking about the sequestration and distribution of Libyan weapons to al-Qaeda in Syria. Yeah, that's right. The U.S. ambassador was brokering weapons through Turkey to al-Qaeda in Syria. Because the American people need to believe that we're at war with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is our enemy. Al-Qaeda are the people that shoot our soldiers after they've been handed their weapon for their police training. They shoot our soldiers in the back, and they will shoot you in the back too if they're given half a chance. Feeding weapons to the enemy of our enemies is a bad way to manage. Ambassador Stevens knew this, and that's why he was killed or allowed to die. And that's why everyone in Benghazi is under a non-disclosure agreement. Because if the American people ever found out that our president took the weapons that were seized from Libyan military, and we're talking about 20,000 missiles and rockets, and moved them through Turkey to al-Qaeda to be used against another sovereign government, it is Iran-Contra on steroids, except we're helping the wrong people. So that's why it's important. Yeah, it's your rights. It's your rights. Al-Qaeda is the enemy of the civilized world, and yet we're feeding them rockets and missiles to destroy another sovereign nation, Syria, with whom we may have a disagreement. That's the way we fight wars these days. Not enough time to go into indefinite detention for U.S. citizens. I will cover that next week. There's one piece that I did want to cover, and that is the Food Stamp Foreign Aid Program. What? You're not familiar with that? Oh, yes, it's a brand new program. Food stamps are paying for transatlantic takeout, with New Yorkers using taxpayer-funded benefits to ship food to relatives in Jamaica, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. Welfare recipients are buying groceries with their electronic benefit transfer, that's the EBT cards, and packing them into giant barrels for the trip overseas, the Post found. The practice is so common that hundreds of 45 to 55 gallon cardboard and plastic barrels line the walls of supermarkets in almost every Caribbean corner of the city. People go in the stores with their food stamps. They buy food for their family and a little bit extra because, as you know, if you've ever had them, food stamps are quite generous. You eat better on food stamps than you've ever eaten in your life. You take the extra and you drop it into the blue plastic barrels. When the barrel is full, the grocery store puts a lid on it, has a truck come pick it up, and off to Haiti it goes. The feds say the movable feasts go against the intent of the $86 billion welfare program for impoverished Americans. A spokeswoman for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food and Nutrition Services said welfare benefits are reserved for households that buy and prepare food together. She said states should intervene if people are caught shipping non-perishables abroad. Michael Tanner, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, called it just another example of welfare abuse. He said, "I don't want food stamp police to see what people do with their rice and beans, but it's wrong." He goes on, "The purpose of this program is to help Americans who don't have enough to eat. This is not intended as a form of foreign aid. The United States spent $522.7 million on foreign aid to the Caribbean last fiscal year, government data shows. Still, New Yorkers say they ship the food because the staples available in the States are superior and less costly than what their families can get abroad. Everybody does it, said a worker at an Associated Supermarket in Prospect Lefferts Gardens, Brooklyn. They pay for it any way they can. A lot of people pay with EBT. Customers pay cash for the barrels, usually about $40, and typically ship them filled with $500 to $2,000 worth of rice, beans, pasta, canned milk, and sausages. Workers at the Pioneer Supermarket on Parkside Avenue and Key Food on Flatbush Avenue confirmed the practice. Everybody's doing it. They said food stamp recipients typically take home their barrels and fill them gradually over time with food bought with food stamps. When the tubs are full, the welfare users call a shipping company to pick them up and send them into the Caribbean for about $70. Takes about 3 weeks. Last week, a woman stuffed dozens of boxes of macaroni and evaporated milk onto a barrel headed for her family in Kingston, Jamaica. She said she didn't have welfare benefits and bought the food herself. This is all worth more than $2,000, she said. I've been shopping since last December. You can help somebody else, somebody who doesn't live in this country. A man helping her pack the barrel said, we're poor here, and they're poor. But what we can get here is a luxury to them. One of my favorite listeners writes in and says, maybe they should pack a few barrels for Detroit. Treat it as foreign aid, people. And, you know, you could say what you want to say. Yeah, all that food's going to turn to crap anyway. So you might as well send it wherever you want to send it. It's their food. They can do what they want to do with it. On the other hand, you could say, I kind of like the good old days when they took the food stamps down to Second Street and they traded it for cash, and they saved up the cash and they went and bought a truck from Detroit. That was the good old days. We've stopped all that corruption now. No, you can't sell food stamps for money anymore and save up the money and go buy a car from Detroit. But you can put the beans and rice in a barrel and send it to someone in another country. Well, there you go. There's a lot going on out there, and I really don't know how to get a handle on it. But I will pull a quote from a famous guy you have all met. I just saw the movie again the other night, and I just had to have the quote again. Here you go. See if you can recognize who this is.
Kneel before me. I said, kneel! Is not this simpler? Is this not your natural state? It's the unspoken truth of humanity that you crave subjugation. The bright lure of freedom diminishes your life's joy in a mad scramble for power, for identity. You were made to be ruled. In the end, you will always kneel.
Well, you remember one of the individuals stood up and said, no, not to men like you. And Loki, Thor's brother, responded by saying, there are no men like me. And he looked alone, the only man standing with everyone else kneeling to this demigod, and said, there will always be men like you. January 4th of last year, a local narcotics strike force conducted a raid on the Ogden, Utah home of Matthew David Stewart at 8:40 p.m. The 12 officers were acting on a tip from Mr. Stewart's former girlfriend, who said that he was growing marijuana in his basement. Mr. Stewart awoke, naked, to the sound of a battering ram taking down his door. Thinking that he was being invaded by criminals, as he later claimed, he grabbed his 9mm Beretta pistol. The police say that they knocked and identified themselves, though Mr. Stewart and his neighbors said they heard no such announcement. Mr. Stewart fired 31 rounds. The police, more than 250. Six of the officers were wounded, and Officer Jared Frankham was killed. Mr. Stewart himself was shot twice before he was arrested. He was charged with several crimes, including the murder of Officer Frankham. The police found 16 small marijuana plants in Mr. Stewart's basement. There was no evidence that Mr. Stewart, a U.S. military veteran with no prior criminal record, was selling marijuana. Mr. Stewart's father said that his son suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and may have smoked the marijuana to self-medicate. Earlier this year, the Ogden City Council heard complaints from dozens of citizens about the way drug warrants are served in the city. As for Mr. Stewart, his trial was scheduled for next April, and prosecutors were seeking the death penalty. But after losing a hearing last May on the legality of the search warrant, Mr. Stewart hanged himself in his jail cell. The police tactics at issue in the Stewart case are no anomaly. Since the 1960s, in response to a range of perceived threats, law enforcement agencies across the U.S. at every level of government have been blurring the line between police officer and soldier. Next week on X Squared Radio, we're going to go in depth into the conversion of our local cops into military cops. Here for the final word tonight is my favorite cop, Barney.
Well, well, well. So we're going to have visitors.
Looks like.
Well, I'll tell you something. Those two hoods are in for a big surprise when they get here. They're going to come in here expecting to find some small-town two-bit lockup, a rinky-dink clubhouse. Well, they're going to find out different.
What do you got in mind?
I'm going to show them we're on our toes out here. That the Mayberry Jail matches any big-time pen they've ever served time in.
Barney, there's no need.
First of all, we're going to get rid of all these extra frills. We give them just what they get in the big house. One cot, one blanket, one cracked mirror, period.
Well, I guess we could take some of that stuff out. The doilies need washing.
I'll tell you something else. I said this before and I repeat it now. What we really need around here is an extra deputy.
So, thank you, Barney Fife, and that's a preview of what's coming on next week, I promise. You're going to learn things you never heard before, and you're going to find out what's really going on behind the badge. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.